September 10th, 1975.
Top stories in the news. City Council leaders urge Mayor Bean not to close the Bronx House of Detention and to hire 300 more correction officers. Senate Finance Committee okays a six-month extension of the federal income tax cuts without any federal spending ceiling. This is Lester Smith reporting. Next news as it happens. Next scheduled news, 11 o'clock. Over WOR Radio 710, the talk of New York.
Again, the Voyager returns from the far, angry, turbulent seas, bearing with them tales of woe. And I sense that any minute now, the floor is going to start tilting again. So, would you please bring up that banal piece of music that's behind us? Turbulent seas roaring past the hull of the Celestial in a force-5 wind. The sun standing high overhead, the time 1:15 p.m. or, if you prefer, 13:50. With flying fish skittering before the bow, en route to the island of Guadalupe. And, you know, that ain't exactly the double E train, I can tell you. And it's not like riding a cab uptown on Sixth Avenue in the rain, although there are certain elements that they should have. The championship, for example. Okay. Hold it now. Keep that right there. That, for those of you who haven't heard the last two shows, this is what we're doing for the next, maybe two more of these. I think people basically, all of us, I don't care who you are, man is a nomadic creature. Now, not all animals are. In fact, not many are. They're very rare. Most of the creatures remain pretty well anchored to their specific range, and they don't move out of it. In other words, you don't see polar bears hitchhiking along Route 95 down through the Everglades. No way. Who is it that does that? You guessed, right? It is not the dromedary. One rarely sees an elephant trying to make his way up through the Arctic wastes. Just because they're there? No, no. Who is it who does that? Man. It may not be you, but it's mankind, humankind. They are that. Now, you can say to yourself, you know, you're not. You would be kidding yourself. Everybody has an itch deep down inside of himself to move over the globe. Why do you think that it's only man who's attempting to, land probes on Venus, to step on the surface of the moon? There's never been a recorded squirrel who looked up at the sky and says, one day, squirreldom will land on Mars. No way. It's man. And so much of his history, going all the way back to the very earliest days that we know of, the prehistory days, much of man's history is the history of his travel. The great age of exploration. Do you remember when you read that in school? In fact, they termed that the age of exploration. When people like Francis Drake and Henrik Hudson, John Cook, that was a great man. These people were people who did what all of mankind secretly always wanted to do. See what's on the other side of the next hill. And there's no people in the history of man, outside of possibly the Bedouins, no people in the history of man that have been more driven by this curious urge than Americans. Now, maybe perhaps it's because of our antecedents. You know, this is we're coming into the big year of the bicentennial, and not much has been said about what makes Americans different from the rest of the world. For one thing, the very beginnings of America, the continent was settled by people who took a fantastic chance. Imagine what it would be like to leave everything, even if it's bad, to leave everything, your entire heritage, your physical home, whatever security you had by having friends, people, relatives, and just head out into literally the roaring unknown. And I mean the unknown. I don't mean just pull up stakes and move to Australia, which is what you may think to do today. But that's not the same as pulling up stakes and heading out across incredibly dangerous sea inadequate, but of course, by that standard, they didn't know this, but the inadequate vessel at fantastic hardships, and head out across the ocean to the unknown, literally the unknown. And that's what our country was started with people like that. Even people who came later were pulling up stakes, giving up everything, and coming to another country, which they didn't know where they would land, they didn't know what they would do, they didn't know whether it would work out. Even the recent immigrants, I'm talking about people as recent as, say, the great wave of immigration around 1900, many people living in New York are sons and daughters of people who did that. But to just pull up your roots and have to go into the unknown, it just takes a different kind of guy. Because a lot of them didn't, you know. A lot of them stayed right where they were. And what was the difference? Well, no moral judgment. They were just different kind of people. And so this is one of the reasons why the car, let's take that for example, is more important to Americans than it is to other people in the rest of the world, because we still remain basically a nomadic people who want to keep on the move. You know, nowhere else in the world do people think in terms of when they quit their work, retire in other words, do they leave their hometown and go somewhere else. It's Americans who do that. You ever occur to you that this is not done in the rest of the world? In other words, if a guy is a shoemaker, for example, in Leeds, and he retires, he doesn't move to south of England. He generally stays right there in Leeds. That's the way it is. And that's why when you travel to many countries, you go through towns in various countries, and you're always struck by the fact that there are so many old people, many, many old people. In small towns in Italy, in towns in England and in Holland. And you say, well, what is it? Well, do they live longer there? No. It's just that they don't move and they're visible. In our society, most of the old people pull up stakes and go to Arizona. Or they go to St. Petersburg. Or they go to San Diego. But you don't see them in the towns that they left. And so we're different, really. And then why do they do this? Well, for one thing, a lot of people feel that if their job is over, now they can do what they've always wanted to do secretly, move endlessly over the landscape. How many times have you ever heard people say, well, what I want to do is when I retire, I want to get myself one of them Winnebagoes, and I just want to travel all the time. See, that's not known to a person who lives in Marseille, for example. He doesn't have this desire to get a Winnebago and spend the rest of his life just traveling around. He would consider that extremely inconvenient to begin with. And it is, but we welcome that inconvenience. The last week, I spent a fantastic week. For those of you who've never spent any time on a sailing vessel, you just don't know what you're missing, really, basically. And you don't have to own a sailing boat to do it either. Because in most great areas of the world today now, charter boats are available to anybody who decides to do the ultimate vacation. And it is. If you're that kind of man, It is the ultimate vacation to go traveling on an ocean-going sailing vessel. I'm not talking about the great vessels. By the way, when we were in to show you what other things are available, when we were in, I believe it was Guadalupe, in the harbor of the small town that we landed in. In Guadalupe, we went ashore and we had dinner in a very small native restaurant. Nothing to do with tourist type restaurants where they serve chopped up fish done with tomatoes, and they served local lobsters, great big chunks of them, just served on a plate, and you just grab them. It's the first place I've ever seen where when they came around with dessert, what do you think they gave us for dessert? The wild thing. Everybody kind of flipped. That when the dessert was served, what dessert was a great big platter covered with a big pile of ice cream bars with sticks sticking out of them. You know, that makes great sense when you think about it. I mean, it never occurred to me to have an ice cream bar, but you don't ever have ice cream bars. But nevertheless, in the island, in that Guadalupe is one of the oldest considered the biggest. It's the biggest, most one of the most interesting of all the islands down on the Windward Islands, way down. See, there's two groups of islands, the Windward and the Leeward Islands. The Leeward, if you prefer the non-nautical pronunciation, the Windward and the Leeward Islands. And the Windward are the islands that go... See, I have a world map, which I'm now holding here, audience. See? This is a big world map. It's called the Political World, produced by the National Geographic Society Cartographic Division. It's a very elegant map. And here you see, as the Windward Islands go stretching way out, here we are, way down here. You see Grenada, and here's Barbados, and these are the Windward Islands. And they get the full sweep of the wind as it comes across the trade winds, as it comes this way. Up, they sweep up through here, and as they go over this area here, moving always this way, they're called the Windward Islands because they are in the very teeth of the wind that moves at all times. And that would be logical, you see, when Columbus sailed from here, I'm pointing right now here to Spain. He sailed out of Spain, and as he came down here, the trade winds carry him right through these islands. Now, he would have had to do a different kind of sailing to sail up through here, through the North Atlantic, and come down this way, landing in the direction or in the vicinity of Philadelphia. Actually, he swept down this way and came up, and here he was right in the very teeth of the trade winds, and it would naturally follow that he would land in the Windward Islands, which is where he did. That's right down here off the coast of South America. All this area, San Salvador, but he worked his way up to this area. And you know that the legend of Columbus is still very strong down on those islands. And there are places that you can see that where one of his four voyages. You know, he made four voyages to the New World. Most of us think of that one voyage. He made four of them. And as he traveled throughout the islands, and his brother and other people traveled with his party, they really established a whole European tradition. You know, this is the reason why, I mean, I hope I'm not belaboring obvious history, but the reason why many of the islands down there, and in fact South America, is Spanish-speaking, is because he sailed out of Spain. History would have been very different had, say, one of the English explorers, say, for example, Drake or Cabot, had made the original discoveries in that area. All that area would undoubtedly have been today speaking English would be the basic language. But the whole Hispanic culture down there was culture that was imported by originally Christopher Columbus. Cristoforo Columbus. Colombo. As he sailed through the Windward Passage and first made contact on San Salvador. And he touched at these various islands, and the whole object of my trip last week was to retrace some of a portion of one of Columbus's voyages. He sailed in the vicinity of Guadalupe, Martinique. These, by the way, are French islands, because back in the 1500s, there was a great tussle going on between France and Spain as to who would ultimately control the New World. And France staked out a lot of claims, and so did Spain. And then, of course, there was the English. They were in it, too. And so you'll find English islands down there, French islands, and Spanish islands. And Guadeloupe, Martinique, the Saints, those islands are very French. Very close to those islands, just about 20 miles as we sailed across that strait there, or that very tough passage. Just about 20 miles away is the island of Dominica, or Dominica, depending on how you wish to pronounce it. It's pronounced both ways on the island, incidentally. This island has another culture. It's British, basically, it was originally. So they're very different. People are different, houses are different, and you're just 20 miles away. By the way, I talked to a Frenchman there. They have just established a radio station on that island, which broadcasts to all the Guadeloupe Martinique islands. The 50,000-watt station, by the way, on 1140 on your AM dial. They call it medium wave there. And the reason that they're established on it on a British island is because it's illegal to have a radio station that has commercials on a French island. So they're just outside of the border, and they're broadcasting, and it's Radio Jimbo is their call. They don't have a call sign like we have. It's Radio Jimbo. They just went on the air 3 months ago, and we stood on the shores of Dominica and talked about this as one radio man to the other. We were talking about the whole scene. By the way, speaking of radio stations, and they hear us down there. That's another surprising thing. Do you know that WOR is listened to down in the Caribbean, on the far reaches of the Caribbean, by many people who look upon the station, and it's not just English-speaking people, really, basically, but people bilingual. They look upon this station as a kind of a voice of America, you know, a genuine voice coming out of America, New York specifically. And they listen a great deal to us down there. So they can get music on any other station down there. There's thousands of stations playing music, but there's only one station that has Pagin. So they listen to it. They really do. So, by the way, if you want to know what you're listening to, this is WOR, New York. Now we're back in business here. And I hope you find this interesting. Now, I'll give you some technical. For any sailors that are listening, people who are, you know, into boats, really into them, I'll give you the technical details on what we were sailing on. There were three boats that were in our little fleet. The names, the one I was on was the Celestial, spelled S-E-A, Celestial. The other one was Venceremos, which is spelled V-E-N-C-E-R-E-M-O-S, pronounced Venceremos. The other one was the Luciada. Now, I have the actual technical details on each one of these boats. Magnificent. These are all ocean-going sailing boats, sometimes called yachts, if you prefer. But they're basically built for sail, which means that they're not the same as a cruise ship. A sailing boat moving along under heavy seas is a handful. It takes really competent, serious, very highly trained people to sail them, especially in the kind of waters that we ran into. By the way, we did sail into one island, though, that one night. Fantastic sight. Just one of those coincidences, but a big ship sailed in. I'm talking about a sailing ship. A true museum piece sailed into Guadeloupe the night we were there. And she anchored pretty far out in the anchorage there. It was an unbelievable sight. It was a tremendous sailing boat that was built in 1902. Enormous thing. It was about 250 feet or maybe 300 feet long. And it looked like something right out of the clipper ship age, which it practically was. After all, built in 1902, was not that long after the clipper ship age. And it was a tremendous sailing vessel. She just lay out there at anchor, and you know, it was a fascinating thing to see. It sails across the Atlantic regularly. And people book passage on this baby and sail around. Yes, they sail around. And so we wanted to see it. So we took our dinghy, the little boat that we used to go into shore and to keep contact with other boats. We took this little rubber dinghy with a little 25-horsepower Yamaha engine on it, and we scooted over to this boat, just laying there. Fantastic thing. And he has a full crew of about 20 people to sail this baby. And it is something else, I'll tell you. It's like pictures you see out of, old geography books. Aboard the thing, it has a teakwood deck, polished, honed down to fire, just absolutely. And it's been sailing regularly, by the way. This boat was not rebuilt or anything. It has been sailing regularly since 1902. It was never, chopped up or dry docked or anything like that. She was interned in the war in England. It was basically a Dutch boat built in Holland and had been used for a variety of purposes since 1902. And the reason that it was a sort of a historical boat, it was the first motor sailer in the world. It was the first sailing boat that had motors basically as part of its propulsion system. And there she is. She's down there. Fantastic sight. The sails, the masts on this thing, were roughly 17 stories high. You ready for that game? That's a lot of rigging. And they climbed that rigging, too. These guys were climbing up and down like a monkey. But there she was. So, nevertheless, getting back to these boats that we were on, there were three of us. First of all, the Venceremos. I'll give you the actual technical details of it. She's 65 feet long. She has a 16-foot, 4-inch beam. Was designed by Sparkman and Stevens. And has an IOR rating of 46.8. And the builder was Nautor. Construction, fiberglass teak. Power, Perkins diesel, 115 horsepower. Fuel, 300 U.S. gallons. She carried 415 gallons of water and carries an inflatable dinghy. That's what she is. And other little niceties, it had a refrigerator aboard and a deep freeze. And its navigation, it carried radio telephones. It carried a Cornell SSB. It carried a Sailor VHF, navigational aids, Brooks and Gatehouse, complete electronics. Now, that was the Venceremos. Now, the Lisiada was designed by S.M. Vandermeer, built in England in 1973, is a conventional catch-rigged sailing yacht with steel hull, straight rake stem, and elegant lines. It truly did have elegant lines. The hull is painted white with royal blue boot top line. The overall length is 60 feet and 8 inches. And the waterline length is 46 feet 3 inches. The beam is 16 feet 6 inches at the extreme, and the draft was 8 feet 9 inches loaded. 50 tons gross was what this baby was. And 50 and the tons TM, 62. Sail area, 3,268 square feet. And this baby was powered for auxiliary power by a 190 horsepower Caterpillar engine. That was the Lisiada. Beautiful ship. And she moved real good. Racing, by the way, that was basically a racing vessel, which doesn't come through this information. Now, the one I was on was probably one of the most fascinating boats in the fleet, Celestial. It's an Ocean 71. Ocean meaning the type. 71 is the type number. It's an Ocean 71, the world's largest production fiberglass sailing yacht, designed by E.G. Vanderstot. Notice most of the designers are Dutch. E.G. Vanderstot, from the lines of a famous ocean racing thoroughbred, Stormvogel, which was a great racing ship. And built to the finest standards of old world craftsmanship by Southern Ocean Shipyard Limited of Poole, England. The sister ships include the Trina, also the Ocean Spirit, another Ocean 71 that won the 2,000-mile Round Britain race in 1970 and was the first ever over the line in the Cape Town to Rio race the next year. Very fast-moving vessels. Incidentally, our vessel had aboard her a very odd a piece of almost a dichotomy, because these are not really what you would call luxury, although they're very comfortable. It had aboard her a sauna, which intrigued everybody. Right? A real sauna. And so, well, it was this little cabin scene. It got hotter than hell. It was a real sauna. And so all the other people from the other boats would come over there to look at this thing, and then they'd take the sauna. They'd go through there, the thing would steam them up, and then after you got hot, you know, you'd spend 10 minutes in the sauna, you'd rush up on deck and just do one clean swan dive into the Caribbean. What a great combination. And then you'd cool off, you'd swim around in the water a little bit. The water was, of course, crystal clear. And, oh, one day aboard the ship, I should do a little more historic work here, but I get carried away by the details. We had a guy aboard the ship who was a professional. He just happened to be in the party. He was a professional scuba diver. He did diving. He taught it and had worked in the scuba diving industry out on the West Coast. He was a pro, real pro. And so one day, he was doing diving. Where we go, he would dive, he'd go overboard, and he'd come back and tell us what's on the bottom, like, hey, there's an old wrecked Ford down there, or, you know, that kind of groovy stuff. So one day he came aboard, and he had a conch. Now, you know what conch shells are like. You've seen these big shells. He said, well, there's a fantastic conch bed down there below. They pronounce it conch in the islands. So with that, the cook says, oh, very good. He says, get me maybe 20 of them. So he dove and he put them in a bucket and he kept coming up with these things and finally got about 20 conchs. Very big shells. And we had for lunch that afternoon, he just pulled them out of the water about 10 o'clock and by 12, the guy had it all prepared. There's a special way to take the animal out of the shell. We had Windward Island conch chowder, which is really talk about your gourmet exotica. You just won't get that at the Four Seasons. And it was just fantastic. And of course, they only made Bimini bread. They made island bread for us and stuff. And it was just a little touch of the kind of things that that life has lived like. Ready for some more in there? Would you like to have a few more commercials now to keep your sense of security alive, right? Let's throw the New York type people a little lifeline here. Nothing like a commercial to make you feel like you're back home, right, gang? There you go. I knew you'd make it. And I made some recordings down there, and in the next couple of days, you're going to hear some of these things if you're really interested in sailing and life in the far deep Caribbean. It's not the way most people really think it is. You know, you have this idea that the islands are all sort of resorts, but you have to live down there for a while and to know people down there for a while to understand that it is not all resorts. You know, there's a whole culture, fascinating culture. For example, just in the food, you know, you can always say a lot about a culture in the foods. The foods are quite sophisticated in many of the islands, especially as you get further down, where they get more and more sophisticated. For example, one afternoon we had a magnificent pumpkin soup. See, he wasn't the cook. He was part of the crew, but he did the cooking on board the ship and was a fantastic cook. He was a native and had been on ships for 11, 15, maybe 15 years prior to that, and he was a recognized great cook. They make a great pumpkin soup. Three or four other specific island soups. Soup, did you know that soup is a specific art form of parts of the Caribbean? And when you have one of those island soups, you had a definitive soup. Now, pumpkin, the pumpkin is not the same as the pumpkin we think of, you know, the big orange baby with the face cut in it. They call them pumpkins. They're sort of a gourd. They're of the pumpkin family. But it's a very exotic, excellent dish. Now, there's a lot of interesting things they have down there. For example, cristofino, which is a curious vegetable that is served several times. You could bring cristofino out. It's a very exotic thing. But enough for the food. You know, that's just part of the game down there. As I got specifically more and more into guys, I was standing on the shore, for example, of this island, Dominica, and it's a kind of a remote island. Not many people go there. It's not a tourist island, and from the water, it looks exactly the way you think Pitcairn Island must look, a South Sea island, the palms hanging down over the water, and the The sand is dark sand. It's volcanic sand. And in the back of it, you see these great mountains rising to the sky. It's a very primitive island, not many roads on it. And I'm standing on the beach there, and this guy comes down, a kind of a sad-eyed-looking Caribbean. He's white, but obviously he'd spent his whole life in the Caribbean. He's got a curious, poetic, sad, out-of-it quality. It's hard to put it into words. And I don't know how the subject came up, but he said, I said, how do you like it? And I said, fine, fine, to enjoy. What's it like to live here daily? Well, life just goes on. He said, you never know what time it is, what day it is. Life just goes on. He said, you know, there's one thing in my life, though, that is important. And I said, what? He said, maybe you don't know what this means. And I said, what is it? He says, I'm an amateur radio operator. I said, no kidding. He's VP2 Dancing Queen is his name. VP2DQ. And we couldn't talk to ham radio for half an hour while the water rolled in. And the pig boiled away. Wow, this is WOR New York. Stay tuned for In Conversation.